Stream entry is the most significant stage of awakening, because if we truly understand our relationship to these three domains of being bound, it influences our perspective on everything else. It changes our perspective on everything. Because this is really to do with the tendency to cling, isn't it? And it's really to do with the tendency to cling and to construct a self, not only a myself, but to construct a self in all things, in all people, in all events, in all objects. It is really to do with this movement of identification, of grasping, of clinging, that is in itself always, I think, a movement of contractedness, and it's a movement away from the first two domains of dukkha, isn't it? This is our primary way of reacting to dukkha, the pain of pain. It's our primary way of reacting to the reality of change and impermanence. It's our primary way of reacting to instability. This is the way that we're trying to create permanence, trying to create certainty, trying to create stability in the midst of a world of conditions which is none of those things. So this is the primary movement into, or almost, the practice of confusion. This is the way that we enact not wanting to know. This is the way that we put that into motion. So this is said to be the really critical stage of awakening. But bear in mind that the Buddha did not reserve this for experienced, mature students. This is what he would sit down with with the novice, and he would talk about non-clinging and non-self and about emptiness. Because it's not something esoteric. It's not something removed from our experience. This is something really, really accessible. Now, so the Buddha talked about not about a self, but he talked again about process, the process of selfing. Now, that process of selfing becomes a solidity determined by the degree of clinging that is present in any given moment. So what we actually see is that the movement of grasping, the movement of clinging, is actually what turns process into state. It's what turns verb into noun. It's the way that we construct the I am and the you are and the this is. It's through the superimposing of this tendency, this pattern of clinging, which, as I said, is a reaction, a reflexive reaction to the first two domains of dukkha. Does that make sense to you, that this is what this is all in, this endeavor is all about? So the Buddha talked about the process of selfing in two very distinct ways. Now, the first of these is really concerned with the insight of stream entry, the construction of personality view, the I am of the moment. Now, this is a changing landscape, isn't it? You've seen that landscape change probably at least 100 times today. You know, from I'm bored, I'm excited, I'm a bit depressed, I'm in pain, I'm happy, I'm exhilarated, I'm contracted, I'm spacious, I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a sibling, you know, I'm a whatever I do in my life, you know, I am the I am. Now, much of this is really changeable, isn't it? I mean, you really see those shifts in a single day. It's kind of like, you know, being at the front desk of a hotel, you know, you just don't know who's coming in, you know. And you can see sometimes it feels sort of quite unpredictable, you know. You know, the I am that was so happy at breakfast and feels so depressed at lunch, you think, well, you know, how did that happen? And yet the I am has amnesia. The I am notion lives in an ongoing state of amnesia. The I am at lunchtime who's depressed has completely forgotten or has only a nostalgic view of the I am who was happy at breakfast. The I am of the moment looms large. It looms large. And the I am of the moment, of course, shapes our world of the moment. That's really important to understand. The I am who's down or depressed shapes the world in a particular way. You know, the world is bleak. It's depressing, you know. It's flawed, it's infallibly broken, you know. The I am who is anxious, the anxious me, also shapes the world of the moment. The world is seen as threatening, as, unsafe, impossible to be in, you know. The I am who is born through clinging to a particular craving is the I am in need, you know, the I am who's living with deficit, sees the world as something to serve that particular craving. So the I am and is living and co-arising with the creation of the other. Just as we shape personality view inwardly, we also shape the other. The I am is always dependent. It is always dependent upon something. It is being shaped by something, and it is being bound by what is shaping it. So it creates the other. It creates a self in all things. So it's creating solidity in all things. And this is where the leaking is happening. Because as we create the self in all things, that self or the other, you know, the self that has been created in the other, exists in a self-referential way to me. So that other has some sort of implicit power to frighten me, to make me anxious, to make me angry, to make me happy. And you can see that in that creation of self and other co-arising, co-joined, the possibility of enormous tension, enormous conflict. Now, all of the, if you take this on a much wider level, real level, it is that shaping of personality view that shapes the other that is in the root of all of the sorrows of our time. All of the isms, the racism, the sexism, the ageism, all of this is dependent upon forming an I am that in turn creates an other that has an implicit sense of self that we either want something from or that we fear or that we want to get rid of. Okay? So when we talk about clinging in Buddhist psychology, clinging is an intensification of craving and aversion. It's not something separate. It's an intensification of craving and aversion. So actually you see this developmental or this development of distress actually growing and increasing. So clinging is the next developmental step of craving and aversion. Simply an intensification, simply a magnification. You've probably noticed that in your life. You really, you're averse to something, you really don't like it, how that grows into, I hate it, how I really have to get rid of this because this has the power to actually make me unhappy or make me afraid. I really want this, or I'm kind of attracted to it, I like it, I need, and then the next step is, I need it. And that is the intensification of the craving. So clinging is an intensification of craving and aversion. Craving and aversion are an intensification of not knowing how things actually are, of ignorance. Okay, so you see that kind of leakage. You can see that sort of leakage. And it creates the I am of the moment. So many of those I ams of the moment, they're kind of fleeting and they hardly even make a big impression, don't they? I am this, I am that, I'm my thoughts, I'm my mood, I'm, this particular emotion, some of them are just like hardly registering on the radar. But if you repeat some of those cycles often enough, this becomes the shape of our, that the I am becomes the shape of our mind, and the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our I am, and this kind of hardens into what is called a habitual formation or a pattern. It's the habit pattern of selfing. And that's actually when we start to talk about ourselves as a type. You know, I'm a greedy type, you know, or, you know, I'm an extroverted type, or I'm a shy type. It's where the repetition of certain clinging and creating personality view has been repeated often enough that it seems to exclude everything else, and it becomes actually a way of being. You know, I've made my home in a particular personality view. Doesn't mean it's more true, it just means that we've repeated it more often. We've repeated it more often. So there's two ways that the Buddha speaks about self-construction, you know. One is through personality view, this formation of personality view, which is Sakkaya Ditti, for anybody who wants to know the Pali. The other way of formulating a sense of self is through what is called mana, the conceit of self. Are you familiar with the conceit of self? Because it's not spoken about nearly enough in this teaching today. This word mana. And actually, if you want to sort of have a sense of developmental freedom, mana is what the arhant lets go of. That's one of the last kind of obstructions or chains or binds before full liberation, because it is often so unconscious and so hidden that we hardly even spot it anymore, because it's simply become an assumption of I am. Okay? So the conceit of self is different than personality view, because personality view is very much a fluid movement. Even if we've decided we know who we are, there's still a little bit of fluidity in there, thank goodness, you know. But the mana is far more embedded, this conceit of self, this relational positioning of who I am in dialogue in relationship with others. So there's three forms of mana. I'm either inferior to you, I'm not as good as you. You know, I'm simply not as good as you. Or I'm superior to you, I'm better than you. I'm more worthy than you. And the other form of mana is we are all the same. This is far more hidden, but it is no less toxic or pernicious. Because this is often a story that's been told to us by others, or it's a story of self that we have constructed through our own experience. But it exerts its influence in every area of life, of our lives. Its influence is phenomenal. You know, if I believe myself to be inferior to you, it will influence whether I ask a question in the room or don't, whether I seek invisibility or whether I seek visibility. It will determine my sense of possibility and aspirations. I will probably not strive for too much, because I will have already been convinced of my incapacity and my failure. It will shape about, it can shape so many things. It can shape abusive relationships. It can shape, you know, our sense of hiding in shadows. It can shape, it will probably produce quite a lot of narrative of comparing and judging and evaluating and waiting for, fearing and waiting for critical and negative feedback, sure that it's going to come. You know, it will probably tell us a lot of story about failure and incapacity. It might lead to a lot of envy, a lot of jealousy. You know, looking at all those people who seem to be so much more successful, so much more worthy, so much more capable than I am. So mana, this will obviously, and I hope you can make this connection, will obviously incline the mind towards the kind of personality views that are most frequently shaped. So this underlying tendency towards seeing myself as being somehow inferior will incline the mind towards forming in the present moment personality views that are generally negative, depressed, deflated, failure, unhappy, you know, because I'm actually just not as good as you or not worthy of you. When inferiority conceit is present, we might find it very, very difficult to receive positive feedback. You know, we will be sure that it's not real. You know, we may find it very difficult to receive metta, kindness or compassion for others, convinced already that we are not worthy of it. You know, we might actually spend quite a bit of time just trying to be invisible in some way. But I hope you see about how that's going to incline the mind towards clinging in some areas far more strongly than others. You know, the person who actually is really invested in inferiority view is probably not very likely to cling to thoughts of grandeur, you know, or striving or progress or, you know, or even happier states. In fact, doubt will be a pretty constant companion. So you think of the position of superiority view, which is less common in our culture. It's not that it's not present, but it's less common. But, you know, think about what responsibility we lay at the feet of superiority view. You know, in terms of exploitation, in terms of oppression, you know, in terms of that being legitimate actions to take part in because I'm better than you. You know, we think about the indifference that comes with superiority view or the desensitization, you know. I mean, mana is a cultural, social issue. You know, it's not just a personal issue. It is a cultural and social issue because it actually shapes the kind of cultures and worlds that we live in. It's actually what perpetuates division. So superiority view, you know, we might actually spend a little bit of too much time patting ourselves on the back. You know, we might have a sense of a inflated sense of pride. We might find ourselves engaging in quite a bit of pity, you know. Oh, those poor people suffering like that, but not necessarily a lot of action or necessarily a lot of care, you know. We again might find ourselves wanting to support that superiority view with a lot of judgment, you know, putting down. We might want to insulate ourselves against any possibility of receiving criticism. You know, we might not need really have a lot of investment in sustaining a certain amount of isolation. There's a lot of difficult things that come from superiority view. And as I say, it's probably not the biggest one for most people in this practice, but it's actually quite a big one culturally. It's quite a big one culturally. You know, and I think in many of our efforts in terms of understanding prejudice and bias, we really actually need to look at mana. I mean, the third of these is, and think about what kind of, how that's going to incline the mind to establishing certain personality views, incline the mind towards clinging in particular areas rather than other areas. And the third dimension of mana is it's called the equality conceit, which is not a good word of it, but it's actually we're all the same. You know, and that's actually when we come out with these interminable statements, you know, no, we're all so greedy, you know, or we're all so deluded, you know, we're all so confused, you know, we're all swimming in this same sea of mediocrity and impossibility, you know, and nobody is ever going to change, and I'm not going to allow anybody to change because I doubt that I can ever change, you know, and it's often from that perspective of you know, equality conceit, it's actually kind of also pretty toxic because we don't want anybody else to succeed, you know. We don't want anybody else to change, you know. I remember when Al Gore, you know, put out his documentary, An Unfortunate Truth, Inconvenient Truth. It's also unfortunate, but Inconvenient Truth. You know, the efforts that went in to pull his electricity bills to show actually, you know, he thinks he's so good, but look at all the electricity he's squandering, you know. I mean, it's this need to pull down, this need to, you know, topple anyone that actually looks to be slightly happier or better off than we are. But this is also going to form personality views. So I think it's very important to understand, you know, because we would wonder, you know, when we see how imprisoning personality view is, the I am, we sort of wonder, well, what is really the compulsion behind it? Why would we do this to ourselves, you know? Why would we engage in these acts of sort of emotional and psychological vandalism? Yeah. It's also really, and it's so important to see how the personality view has got a lot of background behind it, you know, and actually, you know, what sustains personality view? Because, you know, we do, you know, what sustains clinging to an I am? And a lot of it is the narrative we tell, isn't it? Although sometimes this narrative is told to us by others, sadly. But the narrative we tell, you know, I mean, I love that kind of line in some of you know maybe Paul Brock's work. He's a neuropsychiatrist who spent his whole professional life, you know, really trying to establish whether there is a permanent self and has finally given up. And along with most neuropsychologists, I must say, and neuroscientists. And actually what he actually says in his book, he says, you know, we're not telling the story of who we are. The story is telling us who we are. But the story is telling us who we are. And, you know, perhaps you get a sense of that inwardly, you know, how the I am generates narrative, doesn't it? Because the I am tends to cling to or to shape itself around that which is unhelpful and unskillful and sometimes unwholesome. Remember, in this teaching, unwholesome is not bad. It's just that it's not true. So the clinging tends to shape itself around the unhelpful, the unskillful, the distorted. And the degree of clinging there is the degree of narrative that is produced. And the narrative then turns back to actually reinforce and solidify the clinging. Have you ever found yourself in one of those loops? You know, I am such a failure, you know, and then the story starts, and I've always been a failure, you know, and I was unloved in the playground, you know, and that's why I was bullied, you know, and that's why everything has fallen apart in my life. And the story just gets bigger and bigger, doesn't it? And then it feeds back to solidify the personality of you. And then that in itself, that solidifying or intensifying of the clinging intensifies the narrative. And that is the sense, isn't it, of really being imprisoned. Really being bound, you know, and actually really hurting in that. Really hurting in that. So the Buddha actually says, you know, to this understanding of anatta, of non-self, this understanding of the emptiness of personality view, is actually quite a big landscape. Because anatta and what is called emptiness and shunyata are totally related understandings. Because we see as long as we are prone to create and construct a sense of self inwardly, we're going to be equally prone to create and construct a sense of a permanent, implicit, independent self in all things. And that's when it becomes the you are and it is. And that's when we invest in the you and the it, this distorted relational way of being where you or it has the implicit power to make me happy or unhappy, to depress me or elate me. And here we are lost, actually, lost in that confusion and the distress that is born of that confusion. Does that ring a bell? Does that clear for you. But the Buddha says this is not a difficult insight. It's not a difficult insight. It's not something that's hidden. And that if we're truly, truly to bring about the end of distress, it has a direct relationship to bringing about the ending of this tendency to construct an I am, to construct a personality view. And the Buddha went on to say, you know, when there is no view of self, there is no view at all. So bearing in mind here, you know, we're not talking about, annihilating the self, we're not talking about erasing the self. We're talking about bringing the tendency to cling to an end and to create, the bringing to an end the tendency to create a view of self and believe that view to be the truth of who we are. And actually what we do see is what clinging does, it always seizes upon a fragment of experience in the moment and mistakes that fragment to be the truth. So the I am, the tendency to cling might seize upon the body, upon something that is happening in the body, you know? Then I am ill, or I am the sufferer, you know? This is who I am, this defines me. The tendency to cling might seize upon a feeling, it might seize upon a perception, it might seize upon a mental formation, it might seize upon consciousness. You know, this is the I am. So the Buddha, you know, really suggested, let us look carefully at the anatomy of clinging. Let us look carefully at the architecture of the I am. Let us look carefully at the process of fabricating a me. Let's examine this carefully. We're not trying to get rid. You know, I mean, the Buddha, you know, just becomes such a big thing and a sort of empty and a kind of mistaken discussion in terms of the Dharma. You know, the Buddha was not talking about no self. You know, the Buddha actually totally talked about moving through this life in a functional way with a perfectly healthy sense of who you are. But that healthy sense of who you are in terms of Buddha's teaching is not about what we've got rid of or what we've become. It's actually a healthy sense of being and deeply established in ethics, in kindness, in compassion, in understanding, in wise action, in wise intention, you know, in wise speech. That this is a cultivation. We are actually cultivating a way of being present in this world that is so, where our sense of moving through this world as a human, you know, in our humanness. You know, there's a wonderful book called The Emptiness of Persons, The Empty Person. The empty person who can move through this world functionally, creatively, engaged, caring, rooted in ethics, in kindness, in compassion, in equanimity, in joy, and in understanding. What we're actually trying to uproot are just the things that cause suffering, are just the tendencies that create alienation and distress, and so much of that can be rooted in this tendency to fabricate an I am. There's a discourse, some of you, or part of a discourse, some of you may have come across, it's called the Fire Sutta. On one occasion, this is actually said to be the Buddha's third teaching. I don't know if that's true or not. On one occasion, the Buddha was dwelling at Gaya together with 1,000 bhikkhus, unlikely to be his third teaching. Didn't have 1,000. That's really lots. If 500 is lots, this is really lots of bhikkhus. And he addressed them thus, bhikkhus, all is burning. And what bhikkhus is all that is burning? The eye is burning, forms are burning, eye consciousness is burning, eye contact is burning. And whatever feeling arises with eye contact is conditioned, whether pleasant or unpleasant. that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fires of craving, with the fires of hatred, with the fires of delusion. Burning with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, I say. And then he goes through all the sense doors. The mind is burning. Seeing thus, bhikkhus, the wise, noble disciple experiences disenchantment towards the eye, towards forms, towards eye contact, towards feelings, whether pleasant or unpleasant, towards the ear, the nose, the mind, towards whatever feeling arises. Experiencing disenchantment, they become dispassionate. Through dispassion, the heart is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. They understand birth is finished, the noble life has been lived. What has to be done has been done. There is no more coming into any state of being. So the Buddha is really talking about the possibility of extinguishing this tendency, this habit pattern of clinging. When he talks about disenchantment and dispassion, he's not speaking about moving into indifference. He's speaking about moving into equanimity and balance and care and responsiveness. But it is about kind of waking up from the dream. The I am is a kind of sad, limited creature. And actually, I must say, not particularly effective in the world. So this is the encouragement to look at where the I am is being shaped and formed. And the most obvious and the most accessible way is the I am definition of the moment. The I am definition of the moment. This is something that we can track and trace in a day. You know, I mean, if we would just do even a little bit more writing of our thoughts, you know, we'd see how often we're moving into personality view. You know, if I'm limited, I'm happy, I'm unhappy. How often we are moving into this, and whether it's possible to bring a pause. I mean, where do you begin to sort of deconstruct that fabrication? You know, it might be at the point of craving and aversion, because these are the first steps we're taking into the I am. We probably won't notice the distortions or the confusions or the ignorance, but we will start to notice the craving and the aversion, because already with craving and aversion, there has been created an other. There has been created a self in something, in a person, in an object, in an ice cream, you know. There has been the creation of an other. So the first part of this process of beginning to move from actually process into state will be through the manifestation of craving and aversion, those movements towards, the movements of away from. That's already, the I am is beginning to be formed. I like, I don't like, I want, I don't want. So the craving and aversion becomes actually the first visible, probably place of this movement into a place of solidity and fabrication. We might be able to pause there. It, you know, it might be that mindfulness actually begins to actually give us a sense of where the narrative is starting to repeat. You know, the narrative of who I am, the narrative of who you are. You know, this is a big signal for us. We're actually well into that fabrication. You know, actually, the fabrication of I am is really somatic. It has such a somatic sense of contractedness, you know? And we can actually feel that, can't we, in craving or aversion, this somatic imprint of contractedness. That might be our signal. You know, our signal may be, you know, when we're actually really feeling ourselves to be, you know, we get familiar with the landscape of clinging, you know. I mean, if you hold a pebble in an open hand, you know, it doesn't hurt very much, you know. If you hold a difficult thought or a difficult emotion or a difficult sensation in an open hand, it doesn't hurt very much. But if you close your hand around a pebble, it has the potential to really hurt. And that's actually what we start to notice, that closing in the mind, that closing in the body. When it starts to really hurt, we actually know we're in the process of fabricating an I am, a personality view. And that's probably going to have a profound impact upon how we relate to the moment. That's going to leak into our actions, our choices, our speech, the way that we move through our day from a place of contractedness or from a place of an open hand. And that's actually beginning to discern that movement from non-clinging into clinging. I want to just really stress that this is not happening in every moment. We go through many moments in our day where there is non-clinging. When there is non-clinging, there is non-selfing. We go through many moments of our day where we're not involved in the impulses of craving and aversion. And those are moments of more stillness, more balance, more sensitivity. So it's learning actually to be sensitive to both. You know, selfing is not a permanent way of being. Mana, the conceit of self, may be much more buried and much more of a sort of background ongoing presence. But actually the actual process of fabricating personality view, this is episodic. This is episodic. This is actually what's arising with clinging and passing when clinging comes to an end. And actually I think in our practice and in our lives it's really helpful to truly sensitize ourselves to both. You know, to notice the moment when we're not the breather and the breather is just breathing itself. To really notice the moment when there is really a wholeheartedness of seeing, a wholeheartedness of attending, you know, a wholeheartedness of listening. And that sense of easefulness in that. Just as much as we notice the moments when there's contractedness and holding and closing down. To really sensitize ourselves to the noticing of both and the flow between those processes, you know, of opening and closing, of opening and closing, to begin to notice not only the fabrication but the non-fabrication. I hope that makes sense to you, because I think there's a, you know, there's such a tendency to sort of almost believe that personality view is so ever-present and so eternal, you know, and so constant, when actually it's not at all. It's not at all, you know. And sometimes by actually highlighting the moments of non-clinging, we begin to really develop the sensitivity, a greater sensitivity, to the moments of clinging, the moments of fabricating and I. Does anybody have any questions, reflections? Yes, please. That's part of the. So the question is, you know, how fluid is mana? You know, is it really that sort of a constancy? For example, you can feel very inferior in relationship to some, but at the same time feel superior to those that you've judged to be lesser than you. Actually, that would be said to be part of the same inferiority conceit. Is almost the need to actually, in order not to totally die of inferiority conceit, to find some people even more inferior. You know, so it's not actually moving into superiority conceit, it's actually just building in the information that actually makes that inferiority conceit more bearable.
So is it changing?
Mana in Buddhist psychology is not that fluid. This is not a socially mobile program. This is actually pretty set. It's kind of more of a constancy. To say it's permanent would not be correct. Because it's obviously changed through understanding, you know. So it's not like the dissolution of mana at sort of full awakening is just out of the blue. In many ways, we're actually starting to question mana all the way along the path. It's just that it doesn't make such a, doesn't have such a loud, visible voice often, although sometimes it does. Actually, what really has the loud, visible voice is Sakaya Ditti, personality view. But mana is also, has a much, it is also supported, obviously, by exactly the same conditions that support personality view in the sense of clinging and identification. You know? This is actually a much subtler manifestation, a much more hardened, we might say, position or view. But obviously, all of the ways that we start to unravel personality view is having a follow-on impact upon mana being unraveled. So it's not that mana has some big unraveling, you know, under the Bodhi tree. It's actually, it has been an incremental unraveling through actually all the practice that is done through in, you know, investigating clinging and beginning to sort of unbind from the clinging. I mean, being aware that what, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion are running through all of these ways of fabricating the self. You know, that fabricating a self can't be separated from those kind of like core manifestations of confusion and greed, hatred, and delusion. So, of course, superiority conceit has got loads of aversion in it. You know, and aversion, certainly in Buddhist psychology, is really rooted in fear and anxiety and insecurity. So it's not that it's independently arisen, it's kind of resting, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion are, you know, kind of prime movers in forming both personality view and positional selfing or relational selfing. Yeah. So it's not like they have no foundation, they have all of those foundations. It's why superiority conceit often has so much investment in defense and assertion and proving and constantly pointing out the faults of others, because actually that's the way that I sort of not only protect that positional selfing, but kind of keep at bay the fears and the anxieties that are so rooted in it. I mean, I think it's a really important question, you know, because actually we can't separate culture from individual, can we? I mean, we can't separate the way a culture is created from individual views that collectivize and actually create a culture. And I think there's often much hidden in that collectivization of views, you know, because obviously views seek support, you know. And we get support by, you know, bonding with those who have very aligned views, you know. And then that creates a norm. That creates a norm. Now, the norm is actually supported by actually not allowing the norm to be altered and to be changed, you know. So I do feel like in this whole discussion there, you know, mana is too important an element to leave out of this discussion. It's too important an element to leave out of this discussion, because we actually don't want to create new collectivizations that actually support any kind of view. I mean, ultimately, that can in ways, you know, be skillful means along the path, you know, creating alternative cultures. I certainly absolutely support that, but not as a way of actually saying, oh, now we're going to collectivize a new norm that's actually, you know, in some ways in some state of tension with that norm, but recognizing how much the collectivization of view is creating the norm, and the sustaining of the norm relies upon keeping the non-norm out. You know? Because if that disturbs the collectivization of views, it's the norm, it's actually going to disturb the individual view, which wants that norm to be sustained. You know, so I just feel like this is like, I feel like in the whole exploration of how the Dharma develops, how our culture develops, how our society develops, what does development rely upon, you know, and how much hidden in that is mana that can be so sort of subtle and nuanced that it's hardly even visible, and yet may be supporting things that are quite unacceptable. quite unacceptable in some ways. So I just feel like when we move into the, you know, when we look at the Dharma, what the Dharma has to offer in bringing dukkha to an end, not just individual dukkha, but collective dukkha, and what the Dharma has to offer in bringing dukkha to an end, I think, you know, it's really important to look at how dukkha is created and sustained, not only individually, but collectively, and how it comes to an end. And, you know, I do think that was the Buddha's concern. He wasn't concerned with just personal awakening. You know, he was concerned with the awakening of our world. And, you know, this is, it's delicate areas, isn't it? Because, like, no one would really, like, want to fess up to superiority view, you know. Well, some might, but I mean, in the Dharma world, that would be considered rather uncouth, we might say. You know, it's actually more acceptable to have inferiority view, because that means we're kind of broken, you know, and, you know, we've got a ways to go, and we're trying to do that the best we can together. But, and even equality conceit, you know, we might want to concede that, you know, there's a lot of conceding that. But superiority view in a Dharma world, that's quite like, that's really dangerous territory, you know. And that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, you know, because this actually can actually be so woven into the fabric of how we see that it is normalized. That it is normalized. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think there are some unarguables, you know, in this discussion. I think there's unarguables around ethics, you know. There's unarguables about collectedness. There's unarguables about freedom and liberation. Everything else is form. I think the very deep and, you know, and this is an insight, you know, in terms of stream entry that really is presented. This is unshakable, to see the emptiness of personality view. This is unshakable. This does not turn us into someone dysfunctional. It actually probably is a big catalyst for being a truly functional, engaged, relational human being. But it's actually, it's said to be the deep insight into the illusion presented by personality view is the insight that liberates. And it has its own path of deepening. And I say we often begin with, actually, as I was just talking about before, beginning really to taste the moments when personality view is not governing how we see and how we act and how we think and how we do choose. Beginning to really taste those moments. And I think this is not like a Bodhi tree moment, this insight. I think this is a maturing and deepening understanding, you know? And this is actually what we're concerned with if we're concerned with the end of suffering. That nothing is fixed. Nothing is fixed. That's actually quite a big thought. You know? It can be a scary thought. But nothing is fixed. You know? The only thing that fixes anything or anyone in place at all is our view of them. And how that view is born of clinging to a fragment. Haven't we seen this so often in our life? You know, like Sam comes on a retreat and he's really noisy and really restless, and we really have a hard time with Sam, you know? And the noisiness and restlessness becomes the whole of Sam, don't we? You know, we see him 10 years later, you know, and just the sight, you know, and there's Sam, you know, that, oh, it's going to be another noisy, restless moment, because Sam is eternally this noisy and restless person, you know. That's who Sam is. You know, and we actually see the only thing that keeps anything at all fixed in place is our view of it. Wittgenstein once said, you know, that words deliver us a picture, and the picture holds us captive. The picture holds us captive. Words deliver us a picture, and the picture holds us captive. You know, I see Sam, I perceive Sam, you know, I have the name, that's Sam. You know, Sam, the name Sam is delivering me a picture, and the picture is holding me captive. But it's also holding Sam captive, isn't it? That Sam can't possibly turn from a noisy, restless person, or maybe Sam has very good reasons to be noisy and restless. But Sam is eternally the noisy, restless person. The picture holds me captive, but the word also holds Sam captive. So it's actually beginning to actually see these moments when these views are formed that nothing is fixed. It's a great liberation to allow for fluidity. It's a great liberation to allow for change and to allow for process. And when nothing is fixed inwardly, nothing is fixed outwardly. This is where anatta and shunyata are so related. Huineng says emptiness includes the trees, the rivers, the stars, good people, good things, bad things. All are held in emptiness. That there's no fixed, independent self to be found in anything. That in a way all our judgments and our opinions, our labels, and there's a lot of them, are all an attempt to fix things and people and events in place. And they're manifestations of clinging. I think it's an endeavor to relieve our almost existential anxiety. You know, the anxiety about change, about insubstantiality, about fluidity, about flux, you know, the very things that the Buddha taught was actually kind of like how things actually are. We actually really don't like it that much. No? Or we're anxious about it. Clinging, in fact, doesn't relieve anxiety, it deepens it. This is just kind of a kind of core psychological lesson. You know, the clinging doesn't relieve anxiety, even though it's an endeavor to relieve anxiety. It actually deepens it because we know on some level within us, we know. You know, we know about impermanence. We know about instability. You know, we know about flux. On some deep level, we actually know this. You know, and so somehow clinging is almost a kind of movement against what we actually know. Which is why it just simply doesn't work to relieve anxiety. And have you noticed, I mean, in your own experience, have you noticed that the more insecure, the more anxious we feel, the more we are prone to try and pin things down, either by explaining them or fixing them or labeling them or strategizing around them. The more insecure we feel, the more we are prone to actually try and make things static and reliable and predictable. We can see that the kind of this loop of distress that is created and recreated. So what is the Buddha suggesting? He's not trying to strip anything away from anyone. You know, he's not trying to deliver us into a state of permanent anxiety and, you know, insecurity. But he's really asking us or encouraging us to make peace with the possibility, you know, the possibility of making peace with actually the realities of our life, the reality of all of our lives. And maybe this is going to help us to be, you know, a creative, a responsive human being rather than a reactive one, you know, rather than the one that is kind of like pushing against that the actualities or the rhythms of our lives. You know, samsara is often translated as walking in circles. And we actually see that when clinging is born of anxiety and distress and feeds anxiety and distress, we are indeed walking in circles. So I think that's a good place for us to end today. We have much more to say about how clinging and creating and fabricating personality view leads to the other two dimensions of sotapanna insight, the skeptical doubt and the clinging to rites and rituals. And maybe overnight you might think about the relationship between those two. May we just take a few minutes.